to have that experience of awe is, at least for the moment, to let go of yourself, to transcend the sense of separation.
Many of the great wisdom traditions of the earth have pointed to what we're calling the overview effect. That is to say, they have realized this unity, this oneness of all life on earth and of consciousness and awareness.
Hello, Earthlings, and welcome back to The Overview Effect, the podcast about the moments in life that shape our perspectives, that lead us to paradigm shifts in the way we see things, and ultimately, to want to have a bigger impact in the world while we're here. I'm your host, James Perrin, and I'm so excited to bring you a very interesting conversation indeed with safe technology advocate and founder of We Are Not Sam, Renate Strahlhofer. Now, obviously, the endless march of technological progress has and continues to bring us many amazing benefits in life. But we seem to be in a stage now where technological changes are being implemented so rapidly and with such complexity that we're seeing either horrific societal impacts, like addiction to our phones or the problems with social media, or we're just seeing the flat-out misuse and corruption of certain technologies by governments and corporations. And in a world of cyber attacks, data farming, surveillance, intrusive technologies like facial recognition scanning, we just can't keep up with the role and impact of tech in our lives. Well, this is what Renate speaks to. As an advocate for safe and appropriate technology use, she asks, how do we use technology in a discerning and meaningful way? Renate shares her personal story from being a young marketer at Telstra on a corporate career trajectory and being part of the rollout of the 3G wireless network. And through that, she saw the haphazard and, quite frankly, unsafe way we were approaching technological advancements in society, which led her to become an advocate for safe technology. But it goes much deeper than that. In this conversation, Renate shares a bunch of information about the way in which technological standards are set and tested, the problems with that, and the practical dangers of being constantly exposed to electromagnetic frequencies. But even deeper again, Renate talks about the mental and emotional and psychological problems that we're just not aware of. Like the fact that we're so addicted to and reliant on our phones to the point where we feel naked without it. This is a wide-ranging conversation, as usual. We talk about a lot of things, including manipulative marketing tactics, cognitive dissonance, the precautionary principle. We talk about conspiracy theories. We talk about the growing influence of big tech, dopamine addictions, being apocalypto-optimists, and so much more. I think you're going to find this conversation fascinating, just like I did. So please enjoy this one with founder of We Are Not Sam and safe technology advocate, Renate Strahlhofer.
Yes, let's do it.
Cool. Renate, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, James. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm happy to be here too, in your home here in Mullum. The floodwaters have receded. The sun is out. So, I've given you context to the show. It's called The Overview Effect. And the reason it's called that is this idea that we can have these moments in our life that are really paradigm shifting for us, that really shape the way we see and interact in the world. And so, I love starting there. And I'd love to ask you, have you had a moment or a story or an experience in your life that has really shaped who you are and led you to see the world the way that you do?
Yeah, one experience that definitely comes to mind, and it's there are experiences in life that I feel for me personally have stamped me in a certain direction, have sort of given me a karmic purpose, I guess you could say. And one of those moments is this: the first day that I went to university, I was studying marketing and social science at the time, and I was in Victoria in Melbourne, and it was my very first day, and there was a lecturer that went up on the stage and it was an auditorium of 700, you know, kids that were there for the first time, first day. And he said, look, I'm going to tell you one story, and if you can resonate, stay in the room, and if you can't, I need you to leave. And he said it in a more profound way than that. I think he dropped a few F-bombs, but it got everyone's attention. And he was standing there, and he was multicolored with multicolored earrings and a multicolored suit on. And I was coming from a private school background. I thought, gosh, what am I going to be learning about marketing from this guy? And it happens to be probably the most important story that I've come back to many, many times in my life. And he said that he had an uncle in a very small town that owned a hair salon, and it was Joe's Haircuts for $10. And everybody went to Joe's because there was no other salon. And after many, many years, there was a new salon opening it up. And that salon had a new sign up and said that we're going to be selling $5 haircuts. So everyone's coming to Joe saying, what are you going to do? It's half the price. You've got to change your prices. And Joe never said a word. But the day came that salon opened, and Joe came in to his salon and he took down his $10 haircut sign and he replaced it with a new sign. And that new sign said, we fix $5 haircuts for $10. And that was his introduction to marketing. And I thought, wow, that was brilliant, because it goes to show that everything that we observe as consumers is based on perception and the stories that are behind it. And that's when I recognized the power in marketing. But at the time, I didn't think that I'd come back to it in a more ethical way. I never really recognized it to have that much potential. So I was studying behaviors and values and understanding how we work with perceptions to really market products and campaigns. But that story, and there's so many times I've referred back to that story, because I feel that the times that we're living in is really challenging our perception of the world and the stories that are being shared to us and told to us. We have to really understand what's the message and what is the perception and the marketing and the push behind it.
Wow. I love that. And I worked very briefly in a marketing role for a big multinational company. It was in an innovation role, which was part of the marketing team. And I remember, I've got an engineering background, so it was all new to me. And I remember sitting in this one meeting, and it was for a beer company, and they were talking about how to sell more beer to people or more product to people when they go into a store. And they were talking about this new initiative that they had where all the signs that when you walk into the store, usually they're pointed at you as you walk in, but they're had realized that they're going to turn them around and face the fridges, because they'd done the study and realized that people walk into the store, they know exactly already what they're going to get, or at least the fridge that they're going to go to, wine or beer or whatever, and they grab that, and it's when they turn to go towards the counter, that's when you've got your chance. And so everything was angled at them then. And I remember listening to that as a complete someone who knew nothing about marketing, going, this is just manipulation. This is just pure manipulation to try to just make a profit. And that really floored me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hearing that. And I mean, you've got extensive background in marketing, and I'm sure you've experienced that over and over again. So what has been your journey through your career, and that's ultimately led you to do what you do now?
Yeah. So once I finished, I'm going to continue on from that university. I mean, I finished uni and I was accepted as a Telstra graduate. So there was about 10 people around the country that were accepted into this program. And essentially, I could do what I wanted to do for 2 years around the company and work in different positions to learn as many skill sets as I can from all the different roles in marketing around the company.
I had exactly the same, but just not in marketing, but I had like a graduate position in a big multinational, same sort of thing, where I could pick and choose and, experience the different parts
of
the team before being on this path to potentially being an executive one day. Yeah.
And it was really exciting because, you know, you felt chosen and all those, you know, egotistical, mm-hmm. naive things that 20-year-olds look for.
Oh, it stroked the ego.
Yeah, for sure. Made everyone proud, you know, the parents. And what ended up happening was I was asked to join the Next G Network team, and there was a small team of 8 people, and they were recognizing my talents in marketing and research and my presentation skills. And they said, look, we really want you to be part of this team. And I was the youngest person on that team. And we won so many awards. And at the time, it was a huge undertaking because it was a $1 billion rollout. It was, you know, I think it was around, it was 98%. That's how much of the geographical locations we could cover. And
this was 3G.
We called it Next G. Yeah. And it was the first time that people could picture message, videos on the go, mm-hmm. Emails. And for us, it was sci-fi when we got a handle on it, but we had to market it to get people excited. They could do video calls and things that they'd probably only seen in the films. And I thought what I was doing was such a great thing because I was so, I felt so, I don't know what the word is, but it's just like you're getting stroked every single day for all the work and all the results that you're getting. And at the time, it was never a consideration of mine what the safety standards or the safety protocols were. And the only reason that it became something that went on my radar was because my husband, we got new routers, you know, with 3G, we got new routers at home. Mm-hmm. And my husband started complaining of sleep disturbance. And I thought to him, I said to him at the time, like, I'm sure it's probably stress or you just need to go for a walk on the beach or it's work related. You know, you just try to find excuses. It has to be anything else because I'm going to protect what I do. Mm-hmm. It cannot be that thing. And he looked me, and it was one of those moments again that stamped me, and he looked me deep in the eyes and goes, I know you think you know, but you don't, and you need to go find out. And I went in to the market research because it was just, you know, there and it was available to me, and I found that 38% of my market had concerns about health effects.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, I go into my executive director's office and any other day of the week in any other, if that was a result for any other thing, it would definitely signal a campaign. You know, you need to do a marketing campaign to address that.
So that 38% would be quite a significant chunk.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Especially on a new technology. So she told me to get my foot out of the door, and there was, in no uncertain terms, it was that moment where your entire body, your system, everything that you know that you experienced brought you to that moment. And I went to a friend of mine in the research department that I knew really well. And I said, look, this is what I'm uncovering, but I need to know how this safety is actually done. And he took me out for a coffee. He refused to tell me in the office. And he said, you won't believe me, but mobile phones are being tested since the mid-90s on a plastic mannequin. And they fill him up with liquid gel. He's got a name. It's Sam. And it's just a big word for dummy. It's specific anthropomorphic mannequin. But they literally test a plastic dummy head with gel and they measure him for 6 minutes on a phone call to see whether or that gel will heat up by more than 1 degree Celsius. Because if it doesn't, then millions of those devices get sold and they only have to test one device in a laboratory of their choice. And that is it. That's the testing. So anyone that says that, oh, we've got proper safety measures in place and safety testing, this dummy head is based on a 6'2" adult male, which is only 3% of the world's population have that head size and shape. Mm. And so women, children, elderly, they're not considered. And when that happened, it was a very short period of time where I left and I went on a runaway train to Switzerland. But in that time, I tried to get colleagues of mine that I was so close to, because you know, anyone that works anywhere, you get close to your work colleagues, and I'm presenting them with the exact same information that I'm uncovering. And what hurt me and what took me many years to try to overcome was this feeling of cognitive dissonance where people choose to look away. And when we see that there are so many good people in corrupt industries because they're choosing to look the other way, that's something that I personally couldn't live with, and I decided to run away. And that's also not a healthy thing, and that really determined many different layers of what I had to uncover about myself in the process and why I ran away and why I came back to it and why I'm doing what I'm doing today.
We actually touched on this before we hit record, which is this idea that when we are, at times, we identify with something so strongly, whether it's an ideology, it could be religious, it could be dietary, it could be company that I work for, and we identify with it and we make that who we are, then any information that challenges that is a challenge to who we are and our identity. And to break that down is extremely hard. It's extremely terrifying for people. And generally, one of two things happens, I think, is that we either cling on to that belief and become even more rooted and convicted in it. And, you know, I can put my hand up and say, guilty, I've been that vegan before. Or or sometimes we can actually, the pendulum can swing completely the other way. And, you know, we completely believe everything that's opposite. And that's when you get the vegan that swings to carnivore, for example, right? and you're right, it happens in these big multinational businesses and in companies, because it's livelihoods, it's people's lives, you know, that sometimes people just want to get up and go to work and get their paycheck and feed their family and zone out on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's too much of a battle for a lot of people to fight sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And in particular in my industry, in, you know, tech, big tech and telco, we're so heavily addicted and reliant on this technology in terms of how we work and also how we communicate with the people that we love, that we have such a strong desire to protect that industry, especially if you're working in that industry and you identify with that industry. But there's also something called the peripersonal space, and that is that something that you touch very often, your body starts to map it out as part of you. So that's often why when you're driving under a bridge and you duck and you go, what the hell am I doing ducking under a bridge? But your body's mapped the car out as part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the time people are so clingy with their technology that they say things like, I feel naked without my technology. They're really reliant and they're having sort of like a really deep relationship with their devices. And I know for one that I'm responsible, and I was responsible for the way in which that played itself out. But now I'm on the other side and I'm on a safe tech journey and helping people uncover how they can use technology in a more discerning and meaningful way. So who I was when I was working in safe tech, I'm still me, but I'm choosing to look at myself and what I can do with a completely different lens. And I think that always comes back to, you know, I did a speech recently at a community gathering, and at the time there was a lot of controversy around Mullumbimby because of, you know, what's happened with this tower. You know, we got the first 5G moratorium on this tower, and then, you know, during the flood crisis they came in and did a 5G upgrade after we've held the longest vigil, and the community was just dispersed because of all the flood crisis. And it was really unfortunate, but what it actually did, and it propelled me to speak about this at the gathering, is that I asked for a show of hands of how many people felt called to do something during the flood crisis, and everyone's hands went up. There was hundreds of people at this gathering. And then I said, how many people were qualified, really had degrees and qualifications to do the work that they did during the flood crisis? And probably more than half went down. And after that, I explained that I believe in the Creator, and you can call the Creator many different names. And I think the Creator doesn't call the qualified. He already qualified the called. And I explain that I don't do what I do because I have a background in telco or a background in marketing. I do what I do because I'm called to do it. And a lot of those stories that I've expressed are part of my calling. And that's when we recognize how important and how beautiful community is when we're working on our calling rather than just our qualifications. And that has a lot to do with who we think we are. And who we are at our core is that calling, is that intuition, is that guidance system that's around us and within us, but also, you know, the connection to the Creator and the Mother. And all of these aspects feed us and our ability to be really discerning with what we do in our lives and how we do it, who we communicate with. And I think it's a really important time in our history and in our lifetimes to recognize our values, to get really clear on them, and to not be so closed off about who you are and what you're capable of, but just being true to your calling and being of service. I think that is the most beautiful thing you can offer.
Yeah. Oh, I 100% agree, because I think of it this way. Two things. One, there's this beautiful quote, which I'm always reminded by, which is, don't look to the world and ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive.
Yeah.
And then I consider that and I think, do I want to live in a world where people stay, I guess, safe and secure, or they don't fully express or discover and then express who they are for fear of being outcast or shamed or, you know, ridiculed, versus would I rather live in a world where there are people out there that have completely conflicting beliefs and certitudes, and that's okay, and we actually celebrate that because we've created a society where people feel comfortable in fully in, like, expressing and integrating who they are. And I think most people, almost everyone, would say, of course, yeah, the second one. But in the reality is that we don't live in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And day after day after day after day, we are, you know, major parts of society are shaming people for their beliefs. And it's funny, isn't it? Because like we've broken that down over the years through, you know, racism and gender inequality and all these things, you know, no, we need to be open. Everyone's open and free to believe and be who they want to be. And we celebrate diversity. But then in certain areas, when it comes to diversity of thought and opinions, we don't celebrate that. We actually go, you're a white-wing conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. And we blame and shame and we mock people and ridicule them and kind of force them to shut up and believe what everyone else believes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange paradox in the world. Yeah. How do you deal with that conspiracy theory tag, because I'm sure you've been called it over and over again.
Oh, yeah. What I find really interesting about that tag is that I don't find it healthy at all to go on either end of the spectrum. You know, whether you're really trusting of the Anthony Fauci's of the world or, you know, someone like Pete Evans. And I think ultimately, and this is something that Pete and I have spoken about, you want people to be guided by their own intuition and to make decisions, and especially that affect their life and their family and their children, based on what is in you personally. And I always say that I feel that what I do, I just help guide people back to themselves. And I think anything around conspiracy is just challenging thought. It's challenging mainstream narrative. It's challenging critical thinking narrative. As I said, both ends of the spectrum. But challenging a narrative is so healthy. And to give it a label, I mean, that's fine. People can give it whatever labels they like. But where I come from and where I think most people come from that are being targeted as right-wing conspiracy theorists, what they're doing is just challenging the status quo. And I for one, think that this is a very healthy and important part of coming to, you know, understand who you really are and why you're here. Because I think that's ultimately why people are in fight or flight response, is because they're so challenged that they choose a narrative that is presented to them rather than the one that they can find within themselves. And that might sound wishy-washy to a lot of people, but I know at my very core that the people I value would tell you the same thing. They would tell you to look within yourself. And anyone that tells you to look at me and what I say and listen to what I have to say, and anyone that challenges what I have to say is X person or Y person, those aren't the people that are here for, you know, for expansion, growth and awareness. They're very much here for dogma, and that's not the field I play in.
It's actually not the what, it's the how, right? It's not what you say, it's how you act. You know, we see, and it's not, it's to your point, like, you said what labeled conspiracy theory is just questioning the status quo and questioning the narrative. That's also science.
Yeah.
That's also the scientific method.
Right? Used to be.
Yeah, exactly. That's also just, you know, hypothesizing, questioning, constantly updating, and that's okay. And it doesn't mean that everyone needs to go and do that and be that. It's not like you all need to be your own, have your own conspiracy beliefs. It's just accepting and actually celebrating the diversity of thought in our society and in our community, and being able to hold the space for multiple opinions and actually being okay with that.
And being okay with perception, and that everybody has the right to their perception of reality. And honestly, I was about to say this before and I totally forgot, but I'm about to forget it again, I think. let me come back to what I was about to say. I think it was a pretty important point, because I got a bit of a chill go down my spine when I thought, you know, when you think, oh, I've got to quickly remember what I had to say, but it's left me now.
That's all right. Well, maybe we'll loop back on that. What I do want to talk about, just to go back a little bit, and I love this topic conversation. I think we'll loop back in a minute.
I did remember it now.
Okay, go. While we're here.
We're talking about perception, and that was the whole story about the $5 haircuts. And with perception, wireless radiation, and this is about perception, wireless radiation, and I've spoken a lot about this with many different scientists and professors from many different countries in the world that I work in, which is around advocating for safe technology and safe studies, right? Proper safety studies. And DNA, it sounds, oh, where's she going? But bear with me for just a second, because DNA is your receiver and transmitter of information. So if you think of yourself, you're an energetic body, you're an energetic being, and you've got your DNA as your receivers and transmitters of information, which means how you perceive the world is based on what this DNA receives and transmits. So if there is a lot of wireless radiation, people say I have a lot of brain fog and, you know, oxygen depletion and all the usual suspects that are associated with over 2,000 peer-reviewed reports about wireless radiation. In fact, Children's Health Defence won a case last year in August. It was a landmark case that wasn't reported on. But the reason they won it is because they could show that this dummy test was fraudulent and negligent, and why we had so many devices out on the market with so much wireless radiation was because they intentionally bypassed safety. And because we're bombarded with this wireless radiation, the agenda, which Robert F. Kennedy Jr. really cleverly expresses, he says that that 5G has become a weapon of obedience, and it's the tool for that. Because what happens is that if you have so much wireless radiation around you and your DNA receivers, transmitters are only picking up on artificial frequencies, it's tampering with our perception of reality. So a lot of people are saying, look, I'm trying to speak to my brother or my mother-in-law or whatever it might be, and I'm expressing something. And they're so frustrated because they feel like that person doesn't get it. But at the end of the day, there's so many environmental influences that are dictating a lot of the time, and I say dictating intentionally, our perception of reality. You know, whether you're glued to a television or a screen or you're completely in a soup of wireless radiation, all of that is based around how does that affect my perception of the world and my role in it and my vitality in this world? And wireless radiation, and I'm not saying it's the only part of it, but it is a big part of how we're perceiving the world.
Well, I guess we know that the heart, I mean, our bodies, but particularly our heart has a very strong electromagnetic field, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't take a scientist to think, well, that will be interfered with as we, you know, as in this body and our hearts walk around and are pummeled by other electromagnetic frequencies. Mm-hmm. But also it's an interesting point around, we already have this veil of technology over, like this lens of technology over our lives. You know, I think I saw you do a post recently about Elon Musk, and he was saying something to this effect. You know, he's got his controversial brain chip that he wants to put in everyone, and his argument against the naysayers is like, oh well, we've already got a veil of technology over our lives, it's just taking the external and putting it internal. Like, saying it like that's okay. like we've got this facade, this I'll describe it like this. I took my son camping a few weeks ago to a beautiful remote campsite called Black Rock, and it was like, we had a few days there, we were swimming in the river and the oceans, and there was no reception and it was just fire and it was beautiful. And then we hopped in the van, we drove down to down south, and we had to stop for food, and the first place we went into was like the shopping center, and we've never been there before. And as soon as we walked in, and it's like lights and ads and, you know, sounds and just bombardment with everything, the first thing he said to me is like, Dad, we've been here before. And I was like, no, we haven't. He's like, yeah, I recognize this. And what he recognized was that this veil, this like matrix that is replicated everywhere to just over what real life is. And I said to her, I said, Noah, where we've just been, that's the real world. Not this, look around. And he looked, and there were people on their phones, and there's an advertiser there, there's someone selling something over there, there's junk food over there. So none of this is actually real. Mm. It's all, we've just created this like artificial layer over the natural world.
Oh. First of all, terrifying. Your son's called Noah.
Yeah.
So is mine.
Love it.
Well, they call it human nature for a reason, don't they? Mm. There is the antidote to all of this is how we can connect back in to what is real and what is raw and what is pure. And this technology does take you into a vortex, you know, and this vortex is an artificial reality. And what Elon Musk suggests is that we're not far from that anyway, so it would just be easy to kind of transition and merge with AI and his transhumanism agenda, which is, you know, something he doesn't really hide. And anyone that knows how to look into and read into Elon Musk will be able to find that very easily. He's essentially, you know, with his, Starlink, for example, Starlink, our kids love looking at the night sky and the stars. I know Noah does. Mine not. and what he's saying is that with those satellites, he wants 50,000 of these low to medium orbit satellites entering our atmosphere, giving us high-speed internet. But he says they won't be able to last for more than 1 to 5 years. So all of that will become debris, and that debris will get in the way of us and our children seeing the stars and the night sky. And for people to understand how nefarious he is and how he sells, you know, a Tesla car and is controversial about certain topics, but at the very core, he's pushing an agenda that really takes us away from nature and from our own bodies, which is nature again. And we need to be so careful. And I'm someone that believes that people look for heroes. And I think that's a really dangerous way to live your life, because, you know, our kids are growing up and they're seeing Marvel heroes. You know, Marvel heroes are wearing masks and capes, covering their faces, covering their identities. That's not a hero. A hero shows his face or her face. And, you know, they don't need superpowers to create change. We everyday people create change. And this idea that somebody with superpowers and super qualifications, you know, Iron Man, Spider-Man, Batman, Superman, I don't know how many there are, but there's a lot. And I'm very careful about expressing to my child that everything that he can look up to in this world is in the natural world. It's in the world that tells you to be raw and to be very discerning and also looking at the cycles that are available, you know, through all the different seasons that we have. And I think we're at a point now in our trajectory as a human race where we are at a crossroads. You know, we can continue going along with the narratives from Hollywood. You know, the film Avatar is a really great example. I remember at the time, this was many years ago, people were calling me, have you seen this film? It's outstanding, you know, visual effects. And I went to see the film with my husband, and obviously I'd had my experience with Telstra and I was extremely discerning when it came to this film. And I couldn't believe how many people were applauding the idea that you would leave your physical body to enter as an avatar and stay that way. And that is exactly what this, you know, Hollywood, you know, these films and everything that they're angling is that they want you out of your body. And Alison McDowell, she actually says it, someone that I think says it brilliantly is Alison McDowell. She talks about the fourth industrial revolution. But interestingly, she says that, and you've got to look this up, it's called the Moonshot Project. I remember when I looked into it, it just blew my mind. But the Moonshot Project is this idea that by 2050, there will be no need for time and space and body and mind. And how do you get there by 2050 unless you make the necessity of having a body a burden? So you create chronic illness and sickness, and people are then kind of forced to upload, you know, their consciousness to an avatar.
Wow.
And this is a government site, and it's just black on white. And when you hear these types of stories that she was telling me, I couldn't believe it, because there's
there's a
helicopter flying above. There's so many layers to these nefarious agendas, you know, the things like with a web 3.0, most people are thinking, well, what's the web 3.0? Well, the web 3.0 is basically sensors that are in paint and building materials that lay on the land and give you permission to access depending on your behaviors. So it's taking it to a whole nother level, and that's the web 3.0. Now, when I say things like 5G, most people assume they understand what 5G is, but 5G is perception again. It's just marketing. It doesn't mean anything.
So let's talk about that then. What is 5G, and how is that different to 3G and 4G that you were involved in? Well, 3G, but how is it? You're right. It sounds like it's just another step of what we already have.
Yeah.
How different is it?
Well, 1G is you can make a phone call. 2G, you can make a phone call and send a text. 3G is you can make a phone call, send a text, and you can use data. And 4G is even more data. And 5G, now this is where it gets very, very different. So for people that think, well, 5G is just an upgrade of 4G or it's a replacement, it's an addition. So every wireless technology, whether it's gone from 3G to 4G, is just another layer in the atmosphere. It doesn't replace 3G. 4G doesn't replace 3G, and 5G doesn't replace 4G or 3G.
It's an addition. 4G will still be there.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely will still be there. And 5G is just a clever ruse of a name, because it just means fifth generation technology. It's the next generation of this technology. But where it's so different is, and I'm going to show you this with my hand, but I'll explain it over the mic. You've got 3G have circular beamforms. they go circular. And then 4G has the same circular beamforms. What happens with 5G is that you get to a certain gigahertz where those circular beamforms become so small, they're called millimeter waves. And they end up looking like laser beam bullets flying into the atmosphere. So that's where it is up. It becomes like what's known as ADS. A lot of people know what that is. It's active denial system, whereby millimeter waves are used in the military to do crowd controls. So that's where millimeter waves were tested in the military.
Of course.
That's right.
Tested, right?
And that's where 5G becomes such a different topic to 4G is because it requires that their infrastructure is so much more closer to the body because it doesn't go well through dense materials, this millimeter wave. Yes. So you would need to create, and this is what's happening in many, many places around the world, you'd need to create, start using utility poles, outside your kids' bedroom windows every 200 meters to put what's called a small cell. And these small cells are basically just backpack size antennas that can read the activity that's going on in your home. And for that 5G, and why it's so different is that 5G ushers in what's called the Internet of Things. Mm. So that your things have microchips and antennas in your home. Let's say, the glass that I'm using, the bed that I'm sleeping on, the shower cap, the shower head, your baby's nappy, the milk carton, the coffee machine, your dog collar. So everything is connected to the internet, and that device outside your kid's bedroom window on a utility pole is reading all of that data, and that data is the new gold, because that way when they understand what you use, how you use it, why you use it, then they can play with your perception of reality.
Well, it's also a marketer's dream, right?
Oh, 100%.
To have that level of information, you know this.
Yeah. and people need to understand that when you're looking at something on your phone and you're wondering, oh, I was just thinking of that, they can read your eye activity and even your brainwave activity with this technology, and they can market to you things that they know through your bodily senses, your brainwave activity, creates a response. And this is where it goes. It's on a level of manipulation that is unprecedented.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's terrifying. And I guess what comes up for me in that is like this idea of addiction that we have. I think we can start to understand that our phones and our screens and technology on a personal level, people understand the concept of addiction to our phones and the detrimental impact that it can have on our mental health, on our kids' attention spans. We understand through, films like The Social Dilemma, and we understand that these big companies like Facebook are farming our data. We are the product.
Yeah.
And that's becoming accepted on an individual level. And we get that we can be addicted individually. But I also think that on a societal level, with technology like this, we have an element of addiction. And I guess a way that I would put it is like, one of the things, so with my background being environmentalism and like ethical business, one of the arguments that I've seen for 5G is, and the Internet of Things, is that it'll allow us to have these technologies which will be more environmentally friendly. For example, driverless cars, which means that not only will we have more of our personal time back, but we will be able to ride share, and we'll be able to have this sharing economy. So there'll be less things on the road, there'll be less emissions, and da da da. Whereas I kind of look at that and I go, well, if we really wanted that, we'd be doing it now. Mm-hmm. We could ride share now. Mm-hmm. We could have less cars on the road now. But so there's this argument like, well, once we do this, then we can have it, which is essentially an addict saying, just one more hit. And then I'll be like, that'll be done. I'll stop. And the truth is we'll never stop until we have the behavior change.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, once we do this, I can envisage, rather than having driverless cars and all sharing them, I can envisage we get driverless cars and then we're all just now sitting in the passenger seat on our screens individually as we're being driven around the world by these cars. Yeah. And we won't actually be sharing cars because we're not already sharing cars. Mm. And it's not until we change the behavior. And so I guess there's a point of like, we've got this addiction, and it makes me think, do we even need another layer of technology? Mm. Like, what's... do we actually need it? We're inundated with screens and technology all the time. At what point will we just be happy with what we've got?
Yeah. And I mean, this is a question I pose to a lot of people. Are you upgrading your devices? Are you upgrading your addiction? Because with every, you know, new fancy camera, it's just marketing, you know. It's really not taking into account that what do you really want to do with your device? Are you using it in a meaningful way, or are you just out of boredom? Are you binge screening? Are you self-regulating with how often your kids can and cannot use devices? Because there are so many people that I know personally that do not want 5G, but they're not willing to change any behaviors that they have with that technology. And it's a really interesting place to be, to observe. And no one's perfect, not myself. And I'm sure you're not perfect either in that sense, James. But ultimately, the power is in your hands. And that's the main message of We Are Not Sam, is that, for example, if you boycott 5G phones, I'm not buying a 5G phone, I've had enough. Mm. I'm not doing this. You're actually disabling that network connection to that infrastructure. So it's just standing there doing nothing because it's not interacting with your device. Now, your device, when it's being just sitting there, you're not really even using it. There's up to 900 handshakes per minute between your device and the nearest tower, the signals per minute. In other words, updating your apps, tracking you and your locations, you know, making sure, you know, if there's anything that needs to change on your phone. And that is a massive amount of signaling that's coming to you to give you an impulse and a dopamine hit. I need to check how many likes I have. I need to see 20 people have just messaged me. I've got to respond to 20 people. And what's a really interesting story is, and I was talking about this with a friend of mine, Tom, there was whale watching season here in Byron, you know, usually towards the end of the year. And we'd go for a lighthouse walk, and I remember this moment. I'd be up at the lighthouse and there'd be this whale in breach. And I did a post about it because it was so profound for me. And it left such an imprint. And I see this whale going out of breach and these people rushing, and they're getting their phones out.
Yes.
And they're not immersing themselves in that moment, in that magic, in that natural connection that's being offered to them. Their sense of the world is to capture that moment rather than just stand there in awe and experience it. And that for me has a lot to do with addiction, is just this idea that if we capture something and if we look at it via our screens, that somehow that has far more weight in terms of how it carries itself than just being present.
Mm.
The technology is not designed to keep you in the present moment. It's designed to keep you hungry for, you know, the distractions. And distractions are not taking you into anything that's meaningful. It's boredom and distraction is usually things that why people spiral when they're not on, you know, these devices, because they're hungry for something that distracts them from themselves.
And that constant dopamine hit that we get over and over, we're dopamine addicts.
Yeah.
You know, we're constantly looking for that next hit rather than just sitting and being and resetting that dopaminergic pathway. And it's actual satire when you explain it like that, the whale example, because here is something that everyone would say that they would love to go and see. And that's why they're there, is to see the whales at the lighthouse. And then as soon as it happens, they view it through the screen. It's actually like you couldn't make it up. It's quite ridiculous. So I want to just loop back to a little bit around, you touched on at the start of our conversation around the way in which these phones and this technology is tested through Sam, the dummy. And we are not Sam. We are not dummies, is what you're saying. How has that testing method changed over the years, and how did it come about, and who kind of regulates that? How does all that work?
So how it came about is they took the top 10% of military recruits in the US, and they said, now that's our ideal mobile phone user. And these are the strongest men in our society. They're 100 kilogram bodies. They're 6'2" tall, adult males with 5 kilogram heads. And they said, we're going to create mobile phones for this guy. And that's how they started creating devices and testing them on a dummy that in their mind represented this man. But the thing about this test is it doesn't have, you know, organs, DNA, organs in itself, but even reproductive organs. It doesn't have the firing and wiring of the brain, cells, none of that stuff.
So the only thing they're testing is temperature?
They're just testing temperature. It's a non-biological test. It's literally like if you want to test the effect of tobacco and you're just measuring heat. That's it. It's a ridiculous test. And there have been 250 of the top EMF scientists, not just scientists, EMF scientists in 42 countries that have been challenging this test for decades. There's over 2,000 peer-reviewed reports that show there is biological harm from wireless radiation. And the in Australia, it's like UPANSA. In America, it's the FCC. But these are the government regulatory bodies that overlook this. But they all refer to one top governing body. So they kind of like, in other words, like pass the ball around and go, it's not us. We're referring to this guy. And then you go to that guy and go, oh, we're not referring to this guy. And that, you know, the rugby ball just keeps getting passed around. But at the very top is ICNIRP, and this is the International Body for Governance. And this is why it's an international standard, because this ultimately, this governing body tests mobile phones based on heat. And there is nothing about this test that you can look at and say, this makes sense. It absolutely doesn't make sense. So if you want to know, and I'm happy to go there, why would they have used a fraudulent test that doesn't measure safety? Because if there was a test, and there are tests that do measure for safety that they choose not to use, then we'd actually be able, or right now, we'd be using technology that's safe. But the deeper layers, and this is what I've uncovered over many, many years, is that they wanted an easy way to bring this technology onto the market, and they bought these agencies, no doubt. And it's ushered in addiction. So right after you've got a fraudulent test, you've got a population addicted to technology, which makes it really easy for where we're at now, which is surveillance. So it's almost systematic in how it had to play itself out, because otherwise, if there was no safety and you're just selling phones that aren't, you know, they're saying, oh, this phone's gone through a safety standard or a safety test, but this is the test. And unless we see ourselves as dummies, which I know you and I don't, then what we've been advocating for with We Are Not Sam is we want proper safety standards and we want proper safety testing, because we believe that we can live in a world with safe technology. And fiber optics, for example, is a safe technology. You know, it's half the greenhouse gas emissions using a wired, you know, a cable that goes under the earth than it is using 5G. So why are we opting for the more unhealthy versions of all these technologies when we could be regulating them so that the technologies are designed and used in a healthy way? The reason is because they don't want it to be. They don't want it healthy. They don't want you using it in a healthy way. And they've got us addicted, so we're already there. And now, right now, as we're speaking, they're ushering in more and more surveillance. And 5G ultimately is all about surveillance. It's not about faster internet, because it's not faster. It's not the fastest internet you can get. Fiber optics is. So if it's really about downloading a movie a minute, I think most people intuitively, if they just sit with that for a minute and go, is it really worth putting 50,000 satellites in the sky that are going to cause debris so I can download a movie a minute? Most people would say no. And we have to start behaving in ways that are really true to what we want to see for our future generations, and especially us as parents. Like, do we want to look up at the night sky and wonder where it's gone because we were too late? And I think we're not too late. I think that we, like anyone, if we shine our light on the things that matter to us, there are more and more people that are shining their light in that direction, and it's really hard for any type of darkness to proceed. So that's what I intend to do, and I'll keep doing that.
But Renat, business and government have our interest at heart. They would never do something like that, would they? Of course not. It's not like there's a precedent for these types of things. It's not like we can point to asbestos, cigarettes or asbestos or amphetamine or DDT or all of these things that have been advocated by business and government in the past that have been horrible for the world and have resulted in all sorts of health complications and lawsuits. And, you know, at the best case, it was naivety back then, or at the worst case, it was, you know, conspiracy. And then you talk about surveillance, people are like, oh, that's conspiracy. Oh, well, no, Edward Snowden uncovered that's not conspiracy. That's actually a thing. Yeah. We are being constantly under surveillance. So I guess coming back to, like, if caring about, first of all, if not trusting big business and government because of past precedents makes you a right-wing conspiracy theorist, then I guess I'd be a right-wing conspiracy theorist. You know, and I guess if advocating for the precautionary principle, which, you know, as a environmentalist and someone who's read a lot about, you know, the environmental movement, which really spawned from that, you know, Silent Spring and DDT and all that, this idea that if we don't fully understand something that is new and unnatural, we shouldn't implement it, which sounds like a really good idea. If that is conspiracy theory, well, then I guess I'm a conspiracy theorist. And it sounds to me that your intent is just coming from, we just want to advocate for safety and care about our community. And with that, just ask the question of, is this really a good thing for our lives?
Yeah, 100%. You've just nailed it. It's very much where we come from and the intention behind this campaign. It's, you know, we're not anti-technology or, you know, any of that. We use it ourselves, but we use it in a way that is safe, and we use Ethernet cables, and we're very conscious of, you know, when our phone is on airplane mode and Bluetooth's off and location settings and Faraday bags. And there are different ways and mechanisms for us to be far more discerning with this technology, as I've said. But I think ultimately we try to use it in a meaningful way. And I think that's where technology does a good thing. Just, you know, not just using it because it's right there and it takes you away.
Yes.
And speaking of the conspiracy theory, just quickly, I've had so many people over the years write me things like, oh, I'm so glad that you're doing what you're doing, and I just want to let you know I'm awake. And I find that a really fascinating topic, this whole idea of, like, either you're a conspiracy theorist and you're awake, or you're sleeping and you're a sheep, or something to that effect, right? But ultimately, I've sort of come to this understanding where it's going to sound pretty harsh, I think. I don't really care if you're awake, because if you're still in bed and you're not rising up on your feet and trying to be part of the change and creating and participating in, you know, in alternative pathways, what good is it being awake if you're in bed? And I see a lot of people with a massive amount of potential that are so overwhelmed by the state of affairs that we find ourselves in right now. And they're missing, because they're in a state of that fear, they're sort of disconnected from their calling in a way, because that fear or that flight fight response is sort of getting in the way. And I think that once we actually step out of our own way and we just feel into the roles that we can play, and there's so many roles that are needed today, more and more people have the capacity and are working towards creating change. But for that to happen, you have to stop giving yourself credit that you know a lot and start giving yourself a lot of credit with what you're doing, with what you're knowing.
I think of that as wisdom and action, you know, and there are lots of times where we can have wisdom and we can know all the things but not take action. Wisdom without action is pointless. Yeah. It's actually useless. And then vice versa, action without wisdom is chaos. You know, that certainly happens in the world too. So you're right, it's wisdom, knowing, understanding, being mindful, being conscious, being intuitive, wisdom, and then also taking action. And that action doesn't mean you need to go and lock yourself to a tower or, you know, set it on fire.
That's exactly right.
It just, there's a whole bunch of things people can do. So that's what I might ask you to leave us with, is what can be that call to action if people want to get involved, or if they want to support, or if they want to learn more, or if they want to, I don't know, have conversations with their loved ones. What can they do?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we have a website, wearenotsam.com, and we have a petition on there to boycott 5G phones. So you make a pledge that you won't buy into this narrative and this technology, and again, putting the power back into the, you know, consumer. It's because what you buy is what you vote for, really. And also our Instagram page, the same name, We Are Not Sam, and Telegram. But ultimately, it's sharing the information and recognizing that when you offer information to someone and you share them, you know, a perspective from someone like me or anyone else, many people have perspectives on this topic, that you're engaging in the conversation. You're not, so many people just send things, but we have to start becoming more engaging with our communities and, you know, with our friends, our family, our networks. And raising awareness right now might seem like it's just a little thing. It's a massive thing. It's a huge thing to raise awareness, because like you go into a room and it's completely dark, if you light a little candle, the darkness literally goes to the corners of the room, and awareness is that candle. And the first step to creating change, it's not the last step, it's the first step, is awareness. And I think we're, as I said, kind of we're beyond the awakening. We're at a phase where we're rising up and we're on our feet, and there's so many people doing it. And we have to recognize that for us to to get through this in a way that is healthy, we have to change our perceptions. We have to be open-minded about our perceptions, and we have to ask people about theirs and have really difficult conversations that are uncomfortable, because in that discomfort, we actually grow. That's, you know, we know that, we see that as children, you know, when they get uncomfortable, they're growing, and these are growing pains even for us as adults. And I think that's what we're in at the moment. And I would encourage you all to, you know, work together. I mean, there's something beautiful to be said about doing something on your own, and there's a lot of power in that, you know, feeling independent to do something on your own. But it's also beautiful to do things together and to feel a supported community, but not in a way that suggests that, you know, I've got this group with me and they, you know, verify everything that I think, but a group that challenges you. Mm. And that really, and that's what I've got. I've got such an amazing group of people around me that I work with every single day, and that whatever I say, they challenge me on it. And it was just, you know, every single day is a challenge, but it's a beautiful thing, because that's how I feel we get really clear on why we're here and what we stand for, and surrounding ourselves with good people with good intentions at the very core is, I think, how, you know, we get to navigate these really incredibly fun times, I have to say, because I've got a friend, Nathan, he says, gosh, this is the most exciting time to be alive. And I have to agree with him, because I've never been more creative than I have been in these last few years, because it means so much more for me and for my family and for the way I want to see this world.
I think you talked about intention just then, and I think that's a beautiful thing, because intention, one, in the way that we approach these conversations or these issues, the intention is not to actually divide. Mm-hmm. It's actually to come together. So something that I'm guilty of, I'm sure you've been guilty of, we've all been guilty of in the past, is sometimes coming at these conversations like we know better. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I'll bring up, I've been that vegan before. so meeting people where they're at with that, the intention is not to kind of go, you're an idiot, you should do, like, it's actually going, hey, this is something I care about and I want to share with you because I care about you and I care about this community. Like, the intention is pure. And yes, I love what you said around this time to be alive. You know, I think about it this way. We're often bombarded with messaging, the doom and gloom, you know, whether it's climate, whether it's war, whether it's this, that, doesn't matter. Like, there's just so many messages out there to tell us that the world is dying and that we're facing destruction, and, you know, our Earth's population is going to boom. It is booming and will continue to grow to 9 or 10 billion people over the next few decades. And that's going to be a real issue and it's a real problem. And I'm sure there will be practical and logistical issues to solve with that. However, on a much bigger spiritual level, I think, well, maybe there's a reason why so many souls are coming here now, because they don't want to miss the show. They don't want to miss this party, this moment in time, right? And so that's a beautiful perspective to hold for me anyway. Mm-hmm. So I love what you said there around, like, let's approach this with the intention and the purity and the desire to have fun and enjoy this experience through these challenges, mm-hmm. rather than look at the challenges and go, oh my God, it's so big and overwhelming. Go, oh, what an amazing opportunity for us to learn and grow together.
Yeah. Eps. I just, couldn't echo that anymore again. Like, it's just, it is a beautiful thing to recognize that, as difficult as it might look, I often I say this and people laugh, but I'm kind of known for it now. I say that I'm an apocalyptimist.
That's great.
So I'm really seeing the goodwill of humanity come through more than ever. I think more than I can remember in my lifetime. But I'm also seeing that there are so many agendas at play that we have to be really conscious of and navigate. But yeah, the optimist is how it ends, you know, the apocalyptic optimist, and that's the internal, you know, the eternal but internal part of who I am at my core, is somebody that looks at the world and goes, yeah, I'm aware of what's going on and I recognize where the things are dark, but I also recognize where there's potential for alternative pathways and to work with community. And I think that the more we go in that direction and the more we recognize each other on the road, then it's gonna be a fun ride.
Yeah, apocalyptic optimist. I'm gonna use that. I'll credit you. But yeah, I mean, I even felt that through the recent flooding events. I mean, it was obviously there was chaos and there was suffering and there was destruction. Mm. And then paradoxically, there was this like amazing community element where societal divisions just broke down and everyone was all in to help one another. And it's a weird thing to say, and I guess I can put my hand up and say, well, my house didn't flood, so it's easy for me to say this. But I would rather live in a world where, you know, there we are at the whim of nature and challenges and suffering, but our intention is to be unified and together and support one another, than be in a safe and secure world, but we're all just divided mm-hmm. and comfortable and not learning and growing and sharing and connecting. Yeah. So it's a strange...
Which is ultimately something that Jambi is an Indigenous custodian here in the Northern Rivers. He says that 5G and a lot of these agendas, they're just a symptom of our disconnection with nature. It's a symptom. So once we do connect and once we come back to who we are and to everything, you know, to each other and to nature, then we heal. And this is forcing us to do that. And so from that perspective alone, nature is playing her part.
So true. So true. Amazing. We might land it there or not, but this has been beautiful. Thank you so much for having me in your home and putting the time aside for this conversation. And then also thank you for the work that you do. You know, you're someone who is standing up for what she believes in with the intention of doing good for the community, knowing that you're going to be challenged about it and just going forth anyway. And I think that is something that the world needs. So thank you.
Oh, thanks, James. And I know this is a masquerade of life, but I'm really happy to be sitting with someone who's putting their face and their energy out there, and I think I've made it really clear that real heroes put their faces out there, and I really appreciate you doing that.
Pleasure. Thank you.
See you next.